Hello and welcome to this special bonus episode of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob G, and I'm sitting here with the man, the myth, the legend, the subject of this bonus episode.
It's very unusual.
Mr. Ryan Turek, how are you, sir?
Hello. How has your vacation, quote-unquote vacation, from Shockwaves been?
I've been working the whole time, man.
I know.
Making bonus episodes.
Yeah.
But it's fun so far, and basically this stemmed from the Shockwaves horror movie club on Facebook, the group.
Yep.
Some of our listeners were asking questions about you, about your likes, your favorite horror movies, your favorite non-horror movies, because the very first episode of Shockwaves was Becca Elric and I pretty much answering these questions, like a get-to-know-you sort of deal.
Yeah.
And
what episode number was that?
That was the very first Shockwaves.
That was the very first one?
Yeah. Huh. And then, you know, when we did similar things with Killer POV, we did one episode that was the non-genre episode. And so people feel like they know us, but you are still, as I heard quoted earlier today with somebody, a man of mystery, apparently.
Oh, God. Well, also, I mean, like, there's a terrific back catalog of other podcast episodes.
Listen,
of the Bloodcast.
People don't know about these things. They're Shockwaves devotees. This is it. This is all they're listening to.
No, this is good. This is good. No. They're either Killer POV or Shockwaves. So that's good. That's good.
So,
I just want to say thanks for having me on because beyond our vacation, I'm going to be gone for a little bit.
Yes.
When we get back, I think we'll be all together the last week of July.
Yes.
And we'll be back with a vengeance. But I think you and Elric will be picking up a couple episodes.
Yeah. We have a guest that we can't turn down.
Right.
That's kind of in the middle of all our vacation. But
great.
We'll hopefully pull that together.
And I'll be in Toronto through most of July. So if there are any Shockwaves listeners, say hi.
Canada.
In case you see me just walking down the street randomly looking around.
It is Ryan. Your eyes are not deceiving you. He is there.
Just around.
Alrighty, so basically this is an idea I came up with for episode one of Shockwaves, because if you were new to the show, I felt that this would give a good idea of our personality, our answers based on this. So pretty much going to give you the same test that we did in the first one.
I'm remembering.
Yes.
This test now.
Yes.
I remember hearing about it on a drive and like just having a good laugh.
Right.
So bring
now we're going to laugh.
Let's do it.
Now we're going
to
laugh at
feel
you,
free
pal.
To laugh at me.
All right. Well, here it is. We're going to start with what I call your five desert island horror movies. So, you know, it's just a fancy way of saying what are your five favorites. But which are the five that you don't think at this moment, because I know this always shifts and changes, that you wouldn't be able to live without. If your plane went down on an island and you had access to a portable
a cloud or a portable DVD player, Blu-ray player that doesn't have sand in it.
Yes.
Well, I took this, you had given me a little bit of prep beforehand.
Right.
And I did think about it. And if I was genuinely stranded on an island.
Right.
First off, I'd be in pretty dire straits. I'd feel pretty bad about myself about how I got to that situation. But what films would I genuinely miss?
Mm-hmm.
What movies do I love so much that I need to have them in my life at arm's length?
Yes.
Here are the five.
All right.
In no particular order, okay? And they all represent something very personal to me, as I would be doing a lot of self-reflection on a sandy beach as a storm was blowing in. So imagine a storm blowing in, and I'm contemplating fucking life, and I'm about to die.
Right.
Fright Night. Bottom line.
Yep.
I think everybody in the group knows this. Fright Night is single-handedly my favorite horror film of all time. I delineate the best horror films and the favorite horror films, but I do love talking about my favorite horror films more. And Fright Night just, it tops the list for a myriad reasons. One, it was kind of, I think, one of the first R-rated horror films that I had been taken to when I was a kid. My father and my grandmother, strangely enough, took me to go see it on opening night, and my father had given me a choice halfway, as we were about halfway to the theater, was get out of the car and walk home if you can't take the heat. If you're going to cry, if you're going to be scared by the film, then you might as well just go home or stick around and watch the film.
Wow.
And I stuck around, yeah. But so that was kind of like one of my formative films. And it just, it's the one kind of non-Mondo, non-contemporary horror movie poster that I have hanging in my house. Contemporary being like, you know, the kind of Mondo prints and stuff
sure.
like that.
You have an OG
But I have an original,
version.
Yeah, yeah. Number two would be Dawn of the Dead.
Okay.
George Romero's Dawn of the Dead. You know, on this strand, you know, on this island, it would help keep me in touch with my bleak situation, being on this island and being devoid of human contact. But, at the time I saw it, I was a teenager and, I was kind of having like these existential questions about life and what better, movie to have you kind of really question all that stuff than Romero's Dawn of the Dead. And,
yep.
and also followed by Day of the Dead. Like Day of the Dead, I think is a profoundly sad movie.
Yeah.
Just because there is no hope. This is it. You know, we're all fucked. And Dawn of the Dead, I think unlike Day, has a little sense of joy. There's a little bit of like this kind of wish fulfillment in Dawn of the Dead that occurs where you have the full run of a mall.
Yeah.
If you can clean it, if you have the survival capabilities to clear out the mall yourself or with friends, then you might as well make the most of it. You know, I want to be, well, I don't necessarily want to be, but I found particular joy watching the team like ransack the mall and just like grab a fur coat. Who wouldn't grab a fur coat?
Yeah.
Who wouldn't grab some tuna and just eat it out of the can? Who wouldn't grab Spam? Who wouldn't do all these things? And, but, you know, in that kind of wish fulfillment of having a giant place like that to yourself, there comes this downside, which is loneliness and sadness. And I just think the movie is absolutely beautiful and the characters are great. You love living with these characters.
Right.
And I think there's a, the quality of a good film is that you don't want it to end.
Mm-hmm.
And I had that feeling once on when I saw Pulp Fiction on opening night.
Wow.
I saw it at the premiere. And when it was over, I was like, no, don't go. Don't go away. I want to live with you guys some more. And Dawn of the Dead was kind of the same way, even though it kind of goes in the direction it goes. I wanted to see, you know, them go on.
Yeah, so, and I don't know if a lot of people know this, but that is Robert Kirkman's inspiration for The Walking Dead.
Oh, yeah.
Is, you know, by the end, he said, back in those early days before it was the huge mm-hmm. thing was, he's like, it's like, I just love those Romero movies, and it's like, what if they didn't have to end?
Yeah.
Like, what if we could just keep following those characters for a little longer?
Yeah.
And that's where that comic book came from, so.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, George.
Yeah, thanks, George. number three, Scream.
All right.
You know, the film just hit at a prime time in my life.
Yeah.
It brought me immense joy, and I just felt it was at a time when I was in film school, and I was just feeling alive. I was becoming an adult, and I was learning who I was going to be as someone who was going to work in the film industry, and also just kind of fine tuning who I was as a horror fan. And Scream came along, and was just so smart and so innovative and so much fun that I just, you know.
Were you, was that though. The, cause this ties into who you are and all, was that, were you working in news at that point? Cause I know that you have a slight journalistic background.
Right. Yeah. No, I was in film school at the time.
Film school.
Yeah. I was at SVA in Manhattan and, I came out in 96. So I was a sophomore.
Wow.
Yeah. I know. Time flies. So yeah, I think I was working at like a Blockbuster. I think I was working at either, St. Mark's Comics or Blockbuster Video. I was mm-hmm. working at one of the two. Number four, Halloween.
Of course.
Nostalgia runs deep.
The original, I think we need to clarify.
Yeah, the original. and I was first, I think.
Can you imagine a fate worse than just being stuck in an island with Rob Zombie's Halloween?
No.
I'm sorry. Oh, I had God. To go there.
It would just be just
like the only movie
a very vicious, angry world.
And not even like the theatrical cut. Like you have to be stuck on an island with the one that has
with
the horrible
with the director cuts.
With the director cut rape.
No, I think I was first introduced to Halloween in a book called aptly titled horror movies. My library had a wealth of film books in a very small section of my public library. And after elementary school, I would run over there to the children's section and then kind of sneak over to the just main book section and just pore over these random horror books. Mm-hmm. And the cover of horror movies is the poster for Halloween. And I was like, I love pumpkins. I love scary stuff. What is this? I love Halloween. And then I was like trying to associate the cover with the movie that was inside the book.
Sure.
And I finally found it and I was like, oh my God, who's this guy? Like, this is terrifying. And then, and I still hadn't seen the film at the time. And then in middle school, we had a Halloween dance and they opened it with the Halloween theme.
Whoa.
And I was like, whoa, what is this catchy little ditty? I need to know what this is. And they had the bass turned up. So there was kind of like a more of a pulse to it.
Nice.
And I walked up to the DJ. I was like, excuse me, what is this? And he held up the Halloween vinyl and I was like, whoa, nice. And then I caught up to the film and obviously it had a great impact on me. And then number five, last but not least, I don't know where I would be without this film. Evil Dead 2.
Yeah.
You know, Evil Dead 2 was, I think, the first film I put on repeat, like, all through my teenage years. Just, I had to know the movie inside and out. And I've said in previous episodes that, I could probably do well not to have to see it for the rest of my life because it lives in my head.
Yes.
And I know every beat. But it's something that if I was on an island and I wasn't, and if I knew I was going to die on this island, I could not see Evil Dead 2 again, I'd probably be bumped out. So yeah, that's my desert island list.
Wow, not bad, man. Those are good classics.
Yeah, Evil Dead 2 was tying with American Werewolf in London.
Ooh, yeah,
really close, really.
That'd
close.
That'd be a tough call for me too, but yeah. I'd probably go Evil Dead 2.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting. All right. Yeah. Well, so there's that.
Now I have to go back and listen to your guys to see where we cross over.
I have no memory of what the hell we said. That was 50-some-odd episodes ago.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is like with lists, just you track me down like a year from now, and
yeah.
I'll have something maybe completely different.
I'm sure my five would be totally different now.
Yeah.
So the second thing was, and this is kind of interesting, the first celebrity encounter you ever had, horror celebrity, because, you know, we all, you and I, young Rob G and young Ryan Turk were circling the same convention halls in New York at the same time.
Yeah, believe it or not, listeners, Rob and I grew up, literally a state apart.
Yeah.
However, for some, you know, as it is, you know, we were just under the same roof quite a bit at conventions. Whether it was
pictures from the same shows,
pictures like from the
Clive
same
Barker
shows,
and Kane Hodder, and those guys,
Fangoria's Weekend of Horrors and Chiller Theater. And
except you went with your dad because your dad was cool, and I had to sneak out and go to these shows.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but so I don't know. Was it a Weekend of Horrors, or who was the first horror celebrity that you met?
Yeah, because my dad took me to a lot of the conventions really early on. Like, he took me to a lot of literary horror conventions, like the World Horror Convention and stuff like that. And I don't even remember where those were. And also at the time I was just young, so I was like, books, man, where are the pictures? Where are the movies? And then ultimately he wound up taking me to shows like Chiller Theater and Fangoria. And, you know, I'm sure there is an early recollection of me like crossing paths was maybe somebody like Lance Henriksen or Jeffrey Combs, but I don't remember it.
Mm-hmm.
Although Jeffrey Combs comes into play later on, I'd have to say like the first horror celebrity interaction that I had more than like a couple minutes with was Stephen King.
Get out of here.
Yeah.
You got to meet the King.
Yeah. It was, 4 Past Midnight was coming out.
Oh yeah.
And Tower Records on 4th Street, downtown New York had a major signing for Stephen King.
Wow.
And they advertised it in the New York Times. My dad and I saw the ad. He said, this is a once-in-a-lifetime experience. We should go. And I was like, perfect. But it's a school day. And he's like, fuck it. You know what? I'm pulling you out of school. And I was like, okay, great. So we hopped on a train, and we went downtown. We got there at the butt crack of dawn. We got there at like really early, like 7:30 a.m. or something like that. I mean, like, and that means I had to get on a Connecticut train pretty early. Because it's like a 2-hour ride. We got down there and we were like the first ones. We were first ones standing there. And
way to go.
Slowly but surely, more people started to like pile in. I'd say about 45 minutes after we got in line. So everybody else kind of took it seriously. There was a diner down the block one of those kind of like really retro diners, and I was like, I need a sandwich. And everybody, we were just like, there was a communal feeling in a line. So if you needed to go to the bathroom, they'll hold a place. We went and got food for one another. I just brought a stack of Fangorias and just read in line. And then he wasn't signing until like 5:30 at night.
Oh my God.
So we finally get in. I brought a stack of Fangorias. I brought a Batman annual that he had written a foreword for, because Stephen King's a big Batman fan.
Yeah.
So I brought that. I bought Four Past Midnight, and I just walked up to him and I was like, I don't know what else to say other than thank you. And I'm glad you're a Batman fan, because so am I. Very excited to read what's in Four Past Midnight. And he was like, that's great, man. And thank you for bringing this comic. He's like, I barely see, you know, people rarely bring this to me. And I was like, awesome. And we just said hi and a few other things, and then we kind of bailed out. And
how old were you around that time?
This was like 1990, so like 14?
14, 15.
14, 15, yeah. Wow. It was crazy. And that was, and then, you know, everything else fell in line. I think it was like once that happened, and I think just for my folks, my parents just saw what a diehard horror fan I was going to be, and they just like nurtured that.
Uh-huh.
So yeah.
That's cool, your dad to be like, screw school, we're going to meet Stephen King.
Oh yeah, yeah. And the great thing is we took tons of photos, and then I just brought him into school the next day, and I was like, this is what I did yesterday.
Yeah.
How was geometry?
That's pretty amazing, man.
Yeah, that's fun.
So the first time you noticed a horror celebrity in something other than a horror movie. And I think this was selfishly so I could talk about the 1990 Flash show when we did our episode one, because that was like, I was a huge comic book guy, and the Flash aired, and like every other episode was like Ken Foray, Jeffrey Combs, Tim Thomerson.
Yeah.
Like everybody that was in a horror movie was in that show.
Right.
And I was like, oh my God, they're in other movies. I know that guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
yeah. I was that kid who was annoyingly annoying. I was that kid when growing up that my parents took me to the movies really early on, but I had this kind of weird memory for things. So
right.
I always sat next to my folks, and we'd see something, and all through RoboCop, I'd be like, oh my gosh, it's that guy. It's that guy. It's that guy from that movie and that guy from that movie. And my dad's like, all right, enough. I got it. You
right.
understand.
Back when we were like the human IMDBs.
Yeah. The human IMDBs with no sense of name, just like right. face.
Yeah.
You know, Ray Wise to me was always my orthodontist. Because he looked like my freaking orthodontist when I was growing up.
That's
I'd be like, oh my gosh, they cast the orthodontist. But, you know, to recognize someone in a non-horror movie, it would be Sigourney Weaver. Because, you know, I'd seen Alien and Ghostbusters, and then Working Girl came out, and my parents rented Working Girl, which is not a movie for a kid my age, but I was like, oh, it's something on VHS, I want to watch it too. And they were like, no. And then I was like, oh, it's Ripley.
Yeah,
and I was like, I love Ripley, and they were like, no, you gotta go to bed, kid. We don't know what kind of, you know, stuff is in this movie.
Right.
So that was the first time, and then it just all fell, you know, all the other stuff fell into place. But yeah, you're right. The Flash had like
everybody in it.
Everybody. That's
yeah,
really funny.
I'm trying to think of what the other, because I know Bruce Campbell was a big deal. Anytime Bruce Campbell appeared in anything that wasn't an Evil Dead movie,
yeah.
Like I would lose my mind. I remember my friend. I mean, Darkman kind of falls in the genre, but I literally remember. My friend jumping up and knocking over the popcorn at the very ending of Darkman to say, holy shit, it's Bruce Campbell.
Well, the funny
and our whole audience was completely dumbfounded. Had no
idea.
Like, what is this kid getting excited about?
Well, I had the reverse reverse reaction to that, because I saw Darkman and I, of course, I went with my dad, and at the end of Darkman, he went, oh, and I was like, who's that? And he's like, I'll show you. And then we had to rent Evil Dead 2, because then he wanted to catch me up. So then I saw Evil Dead 2, and I was like, oh, now I get it.
That's pretty cool.
It's funny, because the Evil Dead films and the universe, everybody who's in it, that became like the kind of face recognition game throughout high school. Because it was like, oh, Ted Raimi, I recognize Ted from that. Oh, Bruce is in Lunatics: A Love Story. Oh, that's funny. what's the... Was it Mantis, the TV show that Raimi did?
Oh,
the
God.
Superhero show?
Was that what it was called, Mantis?
Yeah, something, I think.
Good
so.
God.
Where the guy had like, he was like paraplegic or something, but he had like an exosuit or something. but that was like Evil Dead 2, and everybody who was in that, it was always kind of like just, oh yeah, that person.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
What was up next? Next was actually, this is fun. Your horror date movie. What is a movie? What is a horror movie that you took someone on a date to?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Actually, so I had something on the most embarrassing celebrity encounter, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you will want to hear this because
that
you'll
was
enjoy
optional.
It. Okay. Oh, no.
Most embarrassing celebrity encounter.
This is more exciting because actually Jared will get a good laugh at this, too. Hi, Jared. We were at, you might have been there, too, man.
Uh-oh.
We were at a Weekend of Horrors show in 2006, and it was in Burbank.
Okay.
And there was an after party.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all in this hotel room. And it was like kind of like a who's who. All these horror people, all these guests hanging around.
Yeah.
Butch Patrick came in. He's like, hey, where's the beer, Ryan? And I was like, oh my God, fucking Butch Patrick is asking me where the beer is. You want to know where the beer is? It's in the tub. So we would go to the tub and I'd show him where it was. But I was drunk. So I came out of the bathroom and I was not feeling well. And I saw someone who looked like our mutually good friend, Jared Rivet.
Right.
And Jared, who co-hosts the Horror Trivia here. So I saw this guy from behind. And I was like, oh, it's Jared. I'm going to tell Jim, because I was dumbass. I'm going to tell Jared how drunk I am. So I walk up. I stumble up behind him. I grab him by the shoulders. And I was like, not feeling good. Blah! Act like I'm going to puke all over his chest.
Right.
Turns around, it's Jeffrey Combs.
I knew it. I knew that's where this is going.
Fucking Jeffrey Combs. Jeffrey Combs turns around. And he goes, pardon me? And I was like, oh my God, I suddenly sobered up right away.
And you had never met him before?
I'd never met him before.
God, that's amazing.
I was like, oh my God. Well, hello, I'm Ryan Turek, the, you know,
I'm a journalist. You should take seriously.
I'm a horror journalist. You should take seriously. I work for Dread Central. Shock to be dropped. You know, it's like, oh God.
Wow.
Awful.
That is pretty good. And I remember those days because after that, we started doing our little pre-Fango bashes.
Yeah.
But I want to say that was like, didn't like Ryan Schifrin host like an abominable party or
he
something
did.
In a hotel room?
He
the
did.
Movie Abominable.
Oh, you know what? It might have been that
because
room.
Jeffrey Combs was in it.
Mm-hmm.
That's my
that
guess.
That might have been the party.
Yeah.
Wow. I remember Brian Usna was there. Charlie Johnson
Ridiculous.
Was there. Yeah.
Good times, man.
That was
good
times. Anyways, you were talking about date.
The date movie, yes.
Yeah, the date movies. Well, I mean, I was a nerd. So I didn't actually start dating for reals until like junior year and senior year of high school.
Yeah.
But they weren't real dates. They weren't like, you know, I think I tweeted once that I went to a homecoming for somebody that who was younger. She was like a junior and I was a senior and I didn't even want to go. Like I went. But the new issue of Fangoria with the stand on the cover came out, and I was like, I'd rather just read that. So I bailed. I was a jerk. And, you know, other, like other date-type movies would have been like Major League and Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. But horror, God, I mean, like I took someone to go see Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer.
How'd that end up?
She stuck with me for a
really?
Little bit. Yeah, she was like,
that
I want to see.
A special kind of woman that will stick with you after Henry.
She was like, I want to see a serial killer movie. And I was like, you're just in luck. It's playing. Let's go see it. And she was, and it was a little rough during the kind of when the guys are about to rape that girl. Like they're like videotaping, tearing her clothes off.
Yeah.
There's that kind of rough bit. And then Otis is like, I want to watch that again.
Yeah.
That I could feel both of us were feeling like maybe I should just suggest we go to dinner next door.
Sure.
But at the very end of the day, she was just like, wow, that was haunting. What else can we watch?
Wow.
And I was
all
like,
right.
All right, cool. We're going to watch some other stuff too. What else? Cannibal Holocaust. Another one, I was living in northern Michigan at the time because that was another life of mine. And I might as well just out it. I mean, like I worked a Hot Topic as a day job, as a night job to my day job, which was a pretty serious gig, but I needed to get the hell out of there and move back to Los Angeles.
This is like early Hot Topic days though, right?
Early Hot Topic days, yeah. But I only did it just to date goth girls. And also make a buck so I can get the hell out of there. And there was one girl that I really liked and she was like, hey, this new movie House of Wax came out.
Oh my God.
And I was like, let's do it. Problem was she talked through the whole thing. Oof. And it bummed me out. It bummed me out so much.
That's not a keeper.
Yeah, I was just super bummed too because I just wanted to take the movie seriously and just watch it. And, you know, Paris Hilton came on and it was like groan. And then My Chemical Romance started playing and she was like groan. And I was like, no, I just want to enjoy this. I took myself to go see it the next day and like,
oh, really? Just
it.
Enjoy
yeah,
it?
Just to enjoy it. So that was a bad one. It takes it, I mean, like, it's genuinely hard to date in this industry and date in the horror community, mm-hmm. And find someone who just like gets your taste.
Yeah.
And, and like just connect and clicks.
Would Fright Night be your litmus test movie? Cause for me, it's Evil Dead 2. I have to show you Evil Dead 2 yeah. normally on the first date. Yeah. And if you dig Evil Dead 2, we're going to be fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Fright Night would definitely be it, especially if you haven't seen it. It's more of a kind of a, hey, what do you think of Fright Night? Right. That's what you get on the first date, ladies. You get dinner and then, hey, what do you think of Fright Night? Let's talk about this. Fright Night for sure. It's usually like, do you understand, one, do you understand what my business and how hard and crazy I work and my hours? Two, are you a genre fan, And,
yeah.
And I've dated super diehard genre fans and it just became like dating myself.
Yeah.
And then I've dated like kind of like, yeah, I love horror movies. This is great, And then we just have kind of a mutual sharing of things we've never seen. Like my beloved girlfriend now, she's Filipino and I think date number two, she brought me some Filipino horror movies mm-hmm. and they were wild. They were like these anthology horror films that were very regional, featured some very, very intense, weird creatures that are very specific to the Philippines. Like there's like this kind of vampire that can split its torso.
Wow.
So it will chase you on its arms, like carrying, like pulling itself along in its arms. But what it loves to do is hide under your bed.
That sounds terrifying
while it leaves its bottom half. I don't know. It's very well. I think it's called like, not Shake, Rattle, and Roll. Maybe I'm wrong, but I'm sure someone will check me on this, and I'm sure she will. But it was at that moment, I was like, I'm in love.
Yeah.
I love you.
We need to find those because I'd like to see them and recommend them.
You can find them. Yeah, you can find them at Amoeba, I think, or some video stores, but we'll talk to her about it. And then, it was weird because we initially clicked on Subspecies.
Wow. Of yeah. all the movies.
Yeah, yeah. The great story is, and I'm sure our listeners are thrilled with the story, but no, we had...
Tell us how Subspecies brings relationships
yeah,
together.
No, we had met somewhere, and then she was on Facebook, and she had said, I'm all by myself watching Subspecies at 2 a.m., and I was up at 2 a.m. for some strange reason, and I was like, oh, that's a bummer. I love Subspecies.
Wow.
And then it was it. I didn't say, hey, you want to watch Subspecies together? It was just like Subspecies is great, man.
From a distance. Like, yeah, I like that movie, too.
I like that movie,
too. Try to play it cool.
Oh, God.
All I remember is Denise Duff from Subspecies.
Denise Duff in...
2 and 3 and 4, maybe? I don't remember for sure.
Yeah, those were blockbusters.
She was my full moon crush from those days. Yeah.
Barbara Crampton was mine.
Yeah.
Hi, Barbara.
Yeah. You're still our crush, Barbara.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so favorite genre filmmaker? I know that's a tough one, but...
That is a tough one.
But which one's sensibilities align with your personal taste the most? Whose filmography?
Probably John Carpenter.
Yeah.
Probably John. Close second is Wes. And it'll be a flip flop any given day, but I think John is more consistent,
mm-hmm.
and I can probably, if you look at his body of work, I could probably pick more likes than dislikes. Whereas Wes Craven, you look at his stuff, and there's more and there's likes, but then there's like a lot of that's interesting.
Yeah, you know? There's a lot of that.
There's a lot of that. That's an interesting choice, but I respected the fuck out of what Wes did, you know, and he was always ahead of the curve. He was always rolling with the times, and he gave every generation of horror fan an icon.
Yeah.
You know, he did that, and who else can do that? So so it'd probably be John and then Wes.
Wow.
Yeah.
And lastly, let's talk a little bit about music, because obviously we tend to do some bonus episodes here and there that are music-centric.
Yeah.
In fact, there's one coming up very soon after this episode
that
you guys are going to love. So what are some of your favorite soundtracks? And were you always conscious of movie music growing up?
I was.
Was that something also that your dad kind of told you about?
I think I found soundtracks myself. Mm-hmm. I think it began with Tim Burton's Batman.
Yeah.
Danny Elfman's score meant a lot, and it was such a driving force and one of the first kind of, I think, themes that I ever remembered.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think one of the first soundtracks I ever bought and one of the first soundtracks that I ever choreographed a home movie to. Like, I actually did some, like, weird little home movie, and I edited it to one of the Batman tracks.
Wow.
Yeah. And then you know, other soundtracks that came into play when I was a kid was like Jurassic Park and stuff like that. But I would usually put them on while I was playing Sega Genesis. I wouldn't be satisfied with the song from the video games. So sometimes I just put like stuff on. Like I took, RoboCop versus Terminator, the video game, and I just put on the RoboCop score.
Yeah.
And because I was too cheap to buy the RoboCop score, I just put a boombox next to a speaker and then just hit record at all the key points, even if it had sound effects in it. Yeah. But scores were always important when, you know, growing up, and, you know, it just knew that. One, it was just like another way to connect with the film, and it was just another way to connect with some of the great movie moments, and it was just something I loved the art of the score. But some of my favorites, you know, growing up, Escape from New York was my hands down. Like, if you caught me in high school and was like, "What's your favorite horror film score?" Nobody would ask me that ever. I'd be like, Escape from New York, followed by Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah,
And then when I was in college, it was In the Mouth of Madness. I loved In the Mouth of Madness.
Yeah.
Some of my favorites now, like, I love a lot of the Italian stuff now. Like, and maybe it's just because my tastes have changed, and I'm just like looking for very repetitive themes, because a lot of the Italian stuff is just very repetitive. But
you know what it is? The Italian stuff is just good music. Like, it's not necessarily good horror music.
Right.
You know what I mean?
It's
like,
just good.
It's just good music.
Yeah. It's like, you know, it's just good music. If you ever pick up Eyeball is just,
I've been
like,
meaning to get that. I hear
it's just
good.
One theme over and over and over and over. Just like very, like, slight variations. Like, it might slow down a second. You're like,
right.
Shit's going down.
But that
Eyeball,
but
then it picks
theme.
Back up, you know?
Yeah.
But, and also, I've just been into, like, just discovering a lot of, like, kind of, like, electronica stuff.
Yeah.
Like, synth stuff. There's been a great boom for that. And there's a lot of great artists coming out. So I'm just kind of, like, rediscovering some older guys, some newer stuff. I'm a big fan of the Omen 2 score.
That is a good score.
It's a fantastic score. The Keep. I love the score for the Tangerine Dreams, The Keep. Yeah, those are some of my highlights.
All right.
Yeah.
I feel like I know you better now.
I hope so. I hope everybody knows a little bit of Turek. And hopefully,
that was the whole point of this.
And hopefully it helps inform, you know, kind of like my taste going forward, or, you know, when you're hearing us talk on a podcast, go, why would Ryan say that?
Yeah.
And it's like, Ryan loves slasher movies. Got it. Okay,
right.
Perfect.
No, it's fun to hear, especially when we hear from listeners, how who they align with always changes based on, you know, but it helps to know a little bit of where we're coming from and why we choose these specific titles that we do.
Yeah. But more importantly, listener, it's all about you.
Yes.
It's all about what you love and what defines you. I mean, like, and it really does. It's like, we live in an era in which, everybody kind of feels the need to be justified by someone else online going, oh, this person doesn't like that.
Yeah.
Someone wrote this review and I like this movie. That person. No, who cares?
Yeah.
Care about your, like, honestly, when I was a kid, I did the same thing. Or when I was like growing, when I was in college too, when I read like reviews of like Tarantino knockoff movies that I really liked, I'd be like, how dare they?
Yeah.
How dare you not like From Dusk Till Dawn?
Right.
You don't get it, but it's
Things
like.
Things to Do in Denver is a good movie, man.
Things to Do in Denver, 2 days in the Valley is amazing.
I don't believe these critics. Damn them.
But honestly, at the end of the day, it's about what you love.
Yeah.
You know.
It's what you love. And you know what? This could be fun. What I'll do is after this bonus episode airs, we'll post these questions and open the discussion to our listeners.
Yeah.
We'll start with your five desert island picks you know, go on a first celebrity favorite, genre, director, and kind of see what everyone else thinks.
Totally.
I think that'd be
love
kind
to
of
see
a fun,
that. Love to see that.
Fun thing to do. So thank you for tuning in for this. Of course,
thank you guys.
Follow us all on social media. Mm-hmm. We're on Instagram. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. And please rate and review us on iTunes. And I believe we have an additional little something-something for you this episode.
A little special
because God forbid,
cameo?
Because Elric cannot keep his mouth shut for 3 weeks. He has seen It Comes at Night and wanted to chime in because actually a lot of people were reaching out to him directly to ask him his thoughts. So we're going to close this out with some words from our main man, Elric Kane. We'll be right back.
Hey guys, despite being on break, I knew it would be a couple weeks before we'd get to talk about Trey Edward Schultz's new movie, It Comes at Night, which is obviously being fairly polarizing, and I just got to see it, so I thought I would chime in with us on our bonus episode. Basically, it carries over the formal ambition and kind of fascinating visual style that he had in last year's Creature, which was one of my favorite movies of last year, both visually and also emotionally. I think Creature really connected to me on an emotional level, whereas I don't necessarily have that same connection in It Comes at Night. One of the issues, I think, on paper, all of the kind of boxes that you guys probably think of as a film I'm going to love, this film looks like it would tick. But one of the issues I had is the premise itself, the story, the core idea is just so worn to somebody who's watched, you know, six seasons of The Walking Dead, The Road, and many other like apocalyptic scenarios. So on that level, I felt like there was nothing particularly new or fresh being offered, besides his, you know, rigor of his style, his, you know, excellent work with the performances. I think the actors are all great. I thought Joel Edgerton was fantastic. You know, Christopher Abbott was good. You know, they're all solid actors. The young boy who's now Riley Keough is always fun. Kelvin Harrison Jr. was really good. One of the issues I think with the movie, and there might be some minor spoilers in here, at least towards my feelings of it, not so much the story. I felt like the point of view shifts multiple times between, you know, the father and son. And I feel like maybe by rooting this film very firmly in just one character's perspective, I might have felt the weight of the emotion a little more than I did. I know I have friends who love the movie who felt like they were, you know, nearing a panic attack almost of tension. And so I think some people are going to really get a lot out of this movie, and the people who are unhappy with it seem to be fairly common. It seems like almost every review I've read, especially on Letterboxd, of somebody who, whether they liked it or not, they were in a screening where people vocally kind of raged about the movie afterwards. And I'm definitely a believer that that could be a good sign in the long run. It means the film's doing something, provoking something. In this case, I feel like maybe it's that people felt a little shortchanged on the mystery, and kind of they wanted more. I heard a lot of comments around me just saying, that's it, you know, where's the payoff? And to be honest, where this movie ends, the exact moment, and this isn't a spoiler, where the movie cuts to black, and I knew it was going to cut to black, I wanted a third act. I felt like the film had built to somewhere that I wanted it to really like blast off now and give me something truly special and unique and unforgettable. And instead it doesn't. And it feels like by making the story smaller, and I know it's going for an emotional kind of knockout moment, it just I never emotionally connected in a deep way to the characters. And I think without slamming the movie, I think part of that is my just overfamiliarity with the subgenre, the grimness of that world. There's moments where the characters' interactions begin to lighten things up and kind of pull you in. The great scene with the young teenage son and Riley Keough, who's a young mother, but also, you know, very attractive, and clearly he's having some sort of fantasies about her that are going to get cut short, you know, very quickly as kind of the violence around them kind of encroaches. But, you know, at its most basic, I feel like you'll all have seen the trailer by now. It's, you know, it feels almost like if you're a Walking Dead watcher, the moment where there, you know, you meet another person in the post zombie world and create a commune, and the first two people who would meet and like trust each other and slowly build out that kind of space. It kind of has that vibe to it. It's obviously, you know, would be one of the best directed episodes ever if it was an episode of Walking Dead. I just think for me, I've seen this. And so I think when Ryan first came back from Overlook, I was very disappointed when I heard his initial remarks about this movie, which sounded, I believe he might have even used the word familiar. And I have to say, I'm kind of in line with him. That said, it's going to age well. It's a movie that a couple of years from now, it's still going to look great and be, you know, a great, very well directed follow-up. But I think it really does, in my mind, shortchange, you know, audience in terms of story, and that could just be, you know, me as the viewer. I think probably amongst our listeners, this has probably already been fairly polarizing. And my guilty confession that I have about this movie is that towards the end of the film, my brain kept thinking about was how much I want to see Joel Edgerton play MacReady in a direct sequel to The Thing, because man, did he looks like he's that character in this film. So, you know, I wouldn't say I was, I'm certainly not as upset as many of the audience members around me. I think there's a lot to the film that's of interest to me. It does commit another cardinal sin where all the key horror moments, the moments that are probably being exploited for the trailer, are all dreams. I kind of had a similar problem with Neon Demon, where some of the scariest moments I felt like were being used in a dream sequence. This has it about three times. Outside of those dreams, there's really never, you know, any kind of supernatural horror moment. So it's all very much kind of grounded in the realism of the situation. I think ultimately the biggest gripe I have with this movie is that I think I don't want to say he's scared, but he's unwilling to do what directors like George Romero do so well, which is, on one hand, he has satire and something he's trying to say, but Romero's not scared of also delving deep into the exploitation of the genre itself, horror, and being campy or you know, tropey, and things for an audience to latch on so they can actually be entertained while they're getting to the idea of the piece. I feel like Schultz is, you know, really straying away from ever committing to making a horror film, even though I think on the surface that's what it is. And I think that's a problem. And I think Krisha is actually more successful with its horror elements to me than this film is. That said, looks gorgeous. And, you know, again, another filmmaker whose vision I can't wait to see what they make next, even though this one didn't completely connect with me. So look forward to hearing what everyone thinks about this one online, but otherwise we'll see you after the break.